this year's Feast of Tabernacles, and of course, the last great day. Really do want to thank Mr. Finley, whose first name really is King, that for the wonderful music they provided for us and all those who worked so hard. My wife and I very much enjoyed being able to spend some time this feast with Mr. and Mrs. Bob Dick. We go back a lot of years. Most of you probably know Mr. Dick as somebody who, longtime pastor in the church, been on the council, probably has a lot of leadership, great example of self-control. And I used to think that too. But there's a little four-year-old blonde over there named Emily, who I think after observing her, I thought she was vivacious, but she gives a different meaning to that word. I would call her conniving. And I have it on good authority that when she sits on Mr. Dick's lap and looks into his eyes and says, "Papa," that his self-control disappears. He no longer has any. And that pretty much she gets whatever she wants. So I think that's probably true, but it's also one of the great blessings of being a grandfather. And I think one of the Proverbs say it's a great blessing to see your children's children. And the feast time oftentimes offers us a chance for that. Today's presentation, I will call, is a little bit different than I've done in the past. We are going to be doing a PowerPoint presentation, which I'm sort of learning. My daughter has helped me put this together, and also with some help, obviously, from Dr. Dan and some of those on the crew. If there is anybody over in the overflow, I would suggest you might consider coming over into the main room. The ushers can help you find a chair, because I hate to see you miss out on some of what we're going to cover today. Now, Dr. Dan said, press the bottom button first. All right, it happened. We're in good shape. So let's proceed. Most of you may recognize this sign. How many have ever seen that on a screen and then touched it? The answer is almost everybody. The company called Google is perhaps the most successful company to be launched in America in the last 20 years. They have pretty much taken over the world of internet exploration. The history of Google is interesting. Now, my daughter Bridget graduated from Cal Poly last June and was fortunate to be able to be hired at Google. Google is the most, well, see what happened, it didn't get, okay. Google is a culture of thinking big. They are rated the number one employer in the country currently because they have things that we don't have other places. They have 17 on-site restaurants. They have these fire poles between floors so employees can jump on the pole and come down. They have big water slide type things. They have numerous gyms. They have a car clinic where you can get your oil change in your car free. They have on-site medical and dental free for all their employees. And the list is almost endless. Google has 3,000 applications a day of people that want to work for them. And they currently have about 19,000 employees, so I'm very thankful that my daughter was afforded the opportunity to work there. Virtually all of her new employees are summa cum laude, Harvard or elite school graduates. Most of us clods couldn't have a chance of getting in, but sometimes us clods have brilliant children. I think it's a joke that God plays on us from time to time. But you can see here, one of the things that Google has all around this entire complex in Mountain View, California, are whiteboards. Because the only mistake you can make working for Google is thinking small. There is never any sort of reprimand for thinking big. In fact, they say, think bigger than you ever have before. That's the motto of working for them. And so on these whiteboards, if you are walking down the hallway and you have an idea, you are to get a marker, which are all provided, and you write down your idea. Then the next person that comes along can look at it and say, I got an idea that might help that, and he writes that down. And some of their massive inventions, such as the Google Cloud that covers the earth with supercomputers, were invented by their employees who have been taught to think big. Now this is one of the whiteboards, and these are Larry and Sergey. They are the two founders of Google, both worth billions and billions of dollars apiece, both single, by the way. My dad keeps calling my daughter, asking her to begin flirting with them, but she hasn't done it, thankfully. So these two guys think big, and they have these whiteboards everywhere, and they say nothing, there's no idea that can be faulted for being too big. Now, at Google, they have restaurants. This is a typical office. And I do have this little pointer, which I hope will work. That's a pen. That doesn't work. Okay. This is a typical office of a Google employee. Now that looks a lot like my office, except mine's all messed up paper. This is all inventions and things that this particular employee is working on. At Google, they have bicycles and scooters. Everybody can just grab one and go. They make sure that nobody wastes time or has any reason to waste time getting back and forth. And this is one of the many restaurants they provide for their employees. The word Google, you might, well, how do they come up with a name like Google? It's a mathematical term which is 1 followed by 100 zeros. It is the largest number you can comprehend. In fact, there isn't a Google of anything. Not a Google of stars, not of dust, not of particles, and according to them, not even a Google of atoms. It is a bigger number than exists. They have in the center, they have volleyball courts, they have sports teams of all kinds. They have special places to go and think and be creative. You can even bring your dogs to work with you, provided the dog, of course, is well house-trained and behaves well. So when I bring mine in the into the house, my wife is unappreciated because mine are not that well-trained. The only mistake you can make at Google is thinking too small. And so the title of my sermon this afternoon is Think Bigger Than You Ever Have About the New Heavens and the New Earth. We oftentimes make the mistake of thinking too small about what will come to pass after the New Jerusalem is established. I want to begin this afternoon in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 9. I did not put the scriptures on PowerPoint, so you'll simply have to turn with me to read the scriptures we're going to go through. But you know, God thinks very, very big. We serve a God who thinks far bigger than any of us can comprehend. He said we have a high calling, an upward calling. And sometimes in the, you know, the life that we live with its ups and downs, we begin to think very small about the here and now, and because of that, we think too small about the future. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, in verse 9, it says, "It is written, eye has not seen nor ear heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him." So translated loosely, we haven't even begun to think about how big the reward that God has in store for us is. All we get are, you know, glimmers of light here and there. Paul said we see through a glass darkly. We can barely comprehend what God thinks and what he has in store for us. He says, God has revealed them to us through his Spirit. And I think what Paul is saying is God has given us a glimpse or a glimmer or a slice or a beginning because we have his Spirit. His Spirit is called the earnest or the beginning of the essence of God. The Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. Today I want to talk a little more about the deep things of God and take it as far as deep space. What man knows the things of a man except the spirit of a man which is in him? So men can know physical things, but only God and his Spirit can know spiritual things. Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God. So we have the Spirit of God given to us, greatest gift that we have, and we need to use that to think more like God and to think bigger than we ever have before. Let's go to Revelation chapter 21. In this study or thinking about the new heavens and the new earth, the Greek word here that means there's a new heaven and new earth, and when it says they pass away, it doesn't mean they pass away like disappear. In Revelation 21 and verse 1, he says, "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away." It actually means they've been transformed. The Greek word parachomei means to pass from one condition to another. It means the earth will be transformed and also the heavens will be transformed. The heavens will not remain as they are today forever. Verse 2, "I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." This is describing the conditions where everything is the God family. God is changing the very nature of the earth to a place of spirit habitation. Verse 3, "I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle or the dwelling of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be their God. And as a choir sang, God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death, no sorrow, nor crying, no more pain, for the former things have passed away. When Jesus Christ returns, the earth will be in utter chaos because of the tribulation, the seven last plagues, the trumpet plagues. It's going to be a very disastrous earth he returns to, and it'll have to be completely rebuilt by those living waters coming out of Jerusalem. In fact, the earth is the only place that is inhabitable now, and the rest of the universe is tohu and bohu. It is uninhabitable and inhospitable for life. And that will also apparently be changed. Let's drop down a little bit farther here in this chapter. Down in verse 5, he who sat on the throne said, "Behold, I make all things new." Not just earth, but also the heavens. "I make all things new." He said to me, "Write, for these words are true and faithful." And he said, "It is done." The next question I want to ask is, how will the heavens be transformed? Beginning here with man's history of thinking small, we're going to have a little bit of a review of the study of astronomy. As many of you know, the Church of Europe controlled in a very dictatorial way the thinking of scientists for many, many years. The idea that the Earth was the center of all things and that the sun and planets revolved around the Earth began with the ancient Greeks, a man named Aristotle. And for centuries and centuries, the established religion in Europe protected that as divine doctrine. And no one was allowed to confront it, even if they had proof, scientific proof, that they were wrong. So the reason why man's thinking about the universe was so small for centuries and centuries, in fact, for probably 1400 to 1500 years, was because of the church pictured here. And I think for the most part now they've at least agreed that part was wrong. This is a textbook page out of a 1540 textbook on astronomy. Now, how far, I mean, this is only 400 and about, what, 80 years ago, 470 years ago? Think how small in terms of human experience. It wasn't that far ago that people still thought in these terms. Now, what we have is the center of all things is the Earth. This is a page out of the astronomy book you would have studied. Then we have the moon that revolves around the Earth. Then we have Mercury revolving a little bit farther out. Then we have Venus. And then we have the sun. They actually thought the sun was the fifth revolving orbit around the Earth. Then we have Mars, and we have Jupiter, and we have Saturn. And then they had these extra stars all around that they thought were just sort of God's filler. It's kind of like God's little cone, or you know, the basketball into which we were all placed. Now, after a few men like a man named Copernicus to begin with, and then later Galileo, got their telescopes out and began to plot, and they began to realize, you know what, the Earth is not the center, the sun is the center of our solar system. Now, Copernicus published this diagram, but he did not have it printed and published until the year he died, because he knew that had he published it still alive, that these little guys we saw earlier in the red coats would have thrown him in the dungeon. So here we have the sun is the center, then he has Mercury, then he has Venus, then he has correctly the Earth, then he has Mars, then he has, Saturn's up there, so that would be Jupiter, and then he has the other planets on the outside. So a little bit later, about 1543, we have Copernicus, who put out this diagram along with all of the scientific data, and it literally rocked the world, because the world then came to think that, no, the Earth is not the center of all things, the Earth is like a lot of other things. And that gave way to what was called the Copernican Principle. Now, the Copernican Principle has been the SPS, the guiding light of most astronomical study ever since then. It perhaps has been illustrated best by Carl Sagan, who was an atheist astronomer, one of the more famous astronomers of the 20th century. He said, our imagined self-importance, we imagine the Earth is important. No, he said, there's thousands, perhaps millions of other planets just like ours. There are probably civilizations far advanced from ours. We are nothing important. We are an accident. We are a speck on the horizon. He said, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe. He said, it's all false. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. So because Copernicus said the Earth is not the center, the sun is of our solar system, astronomers later said, well, the Earth isn't even important. You know, God didn't design it. There isn't any God. It fell hand in hand with atheism. And so for many years, astrology, based on this principle, began to think, well, there's nothing here but us. But then they began to see stars, and telescopes were invented in the 1700s and 1800s that saw other stars. And so then they decided, well, all there is one galaxy. The Milky Way, they consider that's all there is. And this is all there was in textbooks for almost all of the 1800s, for about 1600 really, until about the year 1900. Everybody believed all there was the Milky Way, and that we happened to be in the middle of it, and then all the Milky Way revolved around us. Now, the Milky Way most of us have seen. On a clear night, you go out to the stars and you see this sort of more of a band of stars. It's lighter. By the way, you know why it's called the Milky Way? Anyone know? No show of hands? Aha, I'll tell you something you didn't know. One person does. The Romans and the Greeks thought that the goddess and god of the heavens were Zeus and Hela. And at some point in Hela's life, one of her children bit off one of her breasts and the milk scattered across the heavens. So the Romans called it the Via Lacta, which means the way of milk. And that stuck, and today we still call that band of stars the Milky Way. So here we have a rendition. No one's ever seen the Milky Way, by the way. This is a rendition of computers, and you'll find that the Earth sits between the Pegasus and the Sagittarius and the Pegasus arms, so we are up about right here, about top of the E, and I'll tell you why we have to be there in a little while. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 18. So for many years, astronomers assumed that with the Copernican principle, that the Earth wasn't much in the way of being special. They thought there were beings on Mars. They thought there were beings on Venus. They were sure that once we got bigger telescopes and began to investigate the heavens, that we would, in the words of many astronomers, find thousands, millions of other planets just like ours. And we would truly find that we were insignificant and that we were an accident and that there was no God and there was no purpose for us. Now, the man who upset the entire apple cart was a guy named Edwin Hubble. But first, let's read Isaiah 45 and verse 18. Thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, and who established it. He did not create it in tohu or in bohu, in chaos. Notice, the heavens are not mentioned here. He said God created the heavens and the earth, but the earth was not created in chaos or in vain. The heavens still are. Notice, God formed it to be inhabited. The Bible's pretty plain through the inspired writings of Isaiah that the earth alone has so far been formed to be inhabited. This does not sit well with the Copernican theory. The Copernican theory is that earth is just one of many, billions, millions, and that it's all a big accident. But the Bible says very plainly God created the heavens and the earth, but the earth only was created to be inhabited. The rest of it is still in tohu and bohu. God says, I am the Lord, and there is no other. Now let's continue. In the 1920s, Edwin Hubble was this research scientist at the astronomy place outside of Los Angeles, Mount Palomar. I think it's the University of California's astronomy and research place. And he began to use a 100-inch telescope and found things that upset the apple cart. And then he used a 200-inch telescope, which they built because he requested it. And he found what was called the redshift data. That because of the shifting of light, he found that the Milky Way is not the center of the universe. That there are other galaxies out there. And these galaxies are somehow set in a rotating motion and they're expanding and going away from each other. And there's motion out there. And he said, you know, there's a lot more out there than just the Milky Way. So in the 1920s, the astronomers had to open an entire new way of thinking. And that way of thinking was there's much more out there than just us and our little Milky Way. He also demonstrated the universe is constantly expanding, which implied creation. Now, the astronomers and the atheists really hated this. And so what they came up with was called the steady state theory. They said, nah, it looks like it's moving, but it really isn't. It's kind of going back and forth in sort of a dance, you know, kind of, I won't dance for you. But that, of course, was in subsequent years has been completely disqualified. And all of them now agree that the universe is moving and expanding. Edwin Hubble also proved something that was absolutely astounding. The laws of physics, light, gravity apply everywhere in the universe. There's nowhere where the 92 elements that naturally occur don't occur. There are no elements here that don't occur somewhere else. Hydrogen, the light given off as hydrogen and oxygen, other things burn, the metals that are necessary for life here on Earth, all of these things, all of the rules that apply to them, apply everywhere else. Now I want you to turn over to Psalm 19. Psalm 19. And I want to think about this slightly differently today. We sing this sometimes, we read it. It's a beautiful psalm. David no doubt wrote it when he was looking at the heavens. Psalm 19 in verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day and day utter speech. The word firmament, by the way, says the expanse of heaven shows God's handiwork. The Hebrew actually says the expanse of heaven, this fabulous star show that we see every night. Every day it utters speech and night about knowledge. There's no place where their voice is not heard. In other words, the evidence of God's creation is everywhere. Their line has gone out through all the earth. The fact that the earth and the sun and the planets are all in line. All of this is well understood. Their words to the ends of the world. He has set a tabernacle for the sun. God placed the sun where he wants it, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. It is planned. It is where it should be. It rejoices like a strong man to run its race. It's rising from one end of heaven to the other, its circuit to the other end. There's nothing hidden from its heat. Then he says, the law of God is perfect, converting the soul. Now, most of us probably have read that for years. Thought, well, David's kind of changing subjects now. He's thought about the heavens, yeah, they're beautiful. Now let's talk about the law of God. That's not the case. What I believe David is saying is that the laws that govern the stars, the galaxies, and in fact everything about life are as constant and as universally applicable as the laws that are written down in the book of Exodus and Deuteronomy. When scientists have studied not only matter here on the earth, but matter across the universe, what has been almost astounding off the chart of measurement is that all of the forces that are necessary to create life and to hold matter together are absolute constants. And if any one of those 21 constants were moved, even to a degree of perhaps one half of one degree, life would not be possible. I'm talking about things like the gravitational constant. If the amount of mass had a different gravity pull to it, the planets could not rotate. We could not walk on the Earth. Big planets would simply implode. If gravity were even off by a very few percentage points, life as we know it would be impossible. But beyond that, electromagnetic forces that cause protons and atoms to come together, protons and neutrons to form atoms, if that were off even a slight amount, chemistry as we know it could not function. There's a strong nuclear force constant that Einstein predicted and talked about. There's a weak nuclear force constant. All of these things. And there's so many others. There's the mass density. There's, of course, the expansion of the universe rate. There's the speed of light, the weak nuclear force, the gravitational force, the cosmological constant, electromagnetic forces. And most of us don't know too much about them. We're not physicists. But there are 21 forces of nature that make matter possible, that make everything we do work. If any one of those on those dials was off by even a small amount, none of what we know as life could possibly take place. It is an astounding thing to think that some creator, all the way from the very smallest quarks to the very largest, 16 billion light years across the universe, has the exact same laws that apply equally to everyone, everywhere, and they make life possible. Just like God's laws that we have written down for us apply to everyone equally everywhere, and they make real life possible. So when it says the heavens or the expanse of heavens declare the glory of God, and then he says the law of God is perfect, the scientists already know it's perfect. It's just a matter of time before humanity finally realizes that God's written laws are also perfect and apply to make life possible, like the 21 constants of the chemistry of an atom do, or the chemistry of matter. Well, it's called quantum physics for those of us that don't know much about it. The Copernican principle. Copernicus he didn't say this. He said he thought a creator had done this. But since then, they've taught that the Earth is not exceptional, that our sun is typical of other stars, that lots and lots of other G3 dwarf stars out there, that as we begin to look out into the universe, these scientists for over 100 years have said we will find lots of Earths, lots of planets like ours, lots of atmospheres that you can see through that contain oxygen and nitrogen in just the right level. We'll find all sorts of things out there that make life possible. We'll find there are many planetary configurations, not just ours. You could have big, big suns and small, small Earths. You could have all sorts of configurations, they said, that would enable life. And that proves that man is not special and we have no real purpose. Now, because of what this speculation has been accepted as, we've had a lot of Hollywood promoting it. Some of you, maybe, remember this War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, where they thought Martians were coming to the Earth? Because way back when, in the 30s, they thought, oh, there's got to be life on Mars. After all, Mars is our closest planet, and we have life, so obviously life had to be on Mars. And then we have 2001, A Space Odyssey, Star Trek, Star Wars, E.T., remember E.T., phone home, E.T. was, from somewhere crazy way out there. All of these were a part of the concept that there must be life out there. There must be life out there because we could not be special. The entire program is called SETI, which means the Search for Extraterrestrial Life. Now, here's the problem. Well, that's just a problem. I thought you just like this. This is the Earthrise from Apollo 8, and some of us remember this. When this began to be shown, and this is 1968, when the Apollo astronauts went around and circled the moon for the first time, they read the beginning of Genesis. They read, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And some of us remember hearing that on radio or watching it on television. But at that point, they began to realize perhaps the earth really is kind of special, that the moon is just a rock. And the sad thing about it is that a huge number of people, about 1 billion people around the world, worship a religion that's called the moon god of Arabia. They believe that God is a moon. Moon is a god. And now we're up there showing that it's a rock. So some of this astronomy has really proven some great things. But this is the Earthrise. This was, when it was taken, the most impactful or the most serious picture, the most important picture ever recorded. Because we looked back and saw our Earth as a sphere upon which we all live. Now, what has happened since then? We've had lots of satellites. We've had lots of space probes. We are trying all we can to find extraterrestrial life. Explorers have gone out, satellites and probes, Mariner, Viking, Sojourner. Now, this picture is from Viking Voyager 1. This is the Earth from 4 billion miles away. It took 16 years for Voyager 1 to get past Pluto. And they turned Voyager 1 around and took this picture, and this beam of light coming from the sun shows where the Earth is, right there. That's magnified, by the way, about 1,000 times. But that's what we look like now from 4 billion years away. But what all these probes and satellites and tests have done, they've proven that the Copernican principle fails the test every time it is tested. When they took the Land Rover to Mars, they didn't find any microbes alive. They found no life. All they found was a bunch of rock and dirt. And they always try to announce that they found something that could lead to life because that gets them more money. Be very careful when you read these things in the newspaper. There really is no evidence of any life anywhere except on Earth. But believe me, they are still trying. Now, the Hubble telescope, which is 94 inches across, was launched in 1990. They repaired it a few years later, had to put some new lenses on it. And it can see things 12.8 billion light years away. But since they've not found life with the Hubble, they are trying much better. If you have a chance sometime, go on your Google search and look up very large telescopes under design. You'll find that one of the most, there are about six of them right now that are under construction. The James Webb Telescope will be launched in 2013. It is 256 inches across, almost three times the size of the Hubble. And it will not orbit the Earth. It will orbit the Sun 1.5 million kilometers farther out in space. It will be in the Earth's shadow. So we'll have the Sun, and the Earth has a shadow, and 1.5 million kilometers out will be this James Webb telescope that is almost three times the size and power of the Hubble. The largest Earth telescope to date, of course, was the 200-inch Mount Palomar they're building some down in Peru that will be 60 meters across. So instead of seven, they're going to build one now 60 meters across. And some of these are starting to come online because they want so much to find life somewhere else. The search for extraterrestrial life goes on. Additional large telescopes are being built for the purpose of finding life in deep space. Now, what are they actually finding? They're finding debris. They're finding things like this Cone Nebula, which is about 100 million light years across. They're finding Crab Nebula, which is what is left of an exploded star from who knows how many millions or billions of years ago. It's just all dust and hydrogen and gas and various things, and there's really nothing out. This is pretty, but the exploded stars, by the way, the colors come because of the various elements. And since the rules of light are the same and the rules of radio wavography, the astronomers know exactly what elements we're looking at. This is not a guessing game. They know exactly what elements they're looking at. But someday when the heavens are rebuilt, this is what we have to work with. Dust and hydrogen, some oxygen, some helium. Helium is the most prevalent element in the universe. The way planets are formed is that this dust, because of gravity, begins to form sort of a ball. This is really a poor way of telling you, because I'm not capable of telling you the real way it happens, but this is my summary. That eventually enough matter, enough helium and oxygen, actually enough helium and hydrogen come together to start forming a ball, and that creates its own gravity, which pulls in additional helium and hydrogen, the building blocks of elements. And as this mass begins to squeeze on itself, it begins to create other elements, that more and more building blocks are formed so that the other 92 elements of the periodic scale can be created. And eventually, as this, over a period of many, many, obviously, years and lots of external forces that we don't understand exactly, but planets are formed, and this is an area where they know a number of planets and certainly suns are currently being formed. So I'm not sure where this is, but that's probably farther away than most of us could comprehend. When stars explode, they leave a supernova. They actually implode. Sometimes they'll just blow up across the sky, and they are very visible. In the 1800s, there were several. I think the last supernova that lit up and created a lot of light across the Earth was in the 1930s. But they are massive, massive stars that explode. And so what you have left in space is a bunch of debris. And this debris is very hostile to life as we know it. Our closest friend is Andromeda Galaxy, the closest galaxy that we have to us. Of course, it's in the Milky Way. And it gives you an idea of what it is. It's way out there. And you've heard of the Andromeda Strain, a movie. But the Andromeda Galaxy is very far away, and it's something that we simply have very little comprehension of, other than we can see it, and our telescopes can see some of those of the stars around there. I want to go now to Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 28. Now, this is going to be slightly speculative. I don't necessarily apologize for that, but I want you to know that. I've often pondered this scripture and tried to figure out what could this possibly mean. Jesus Christ says in Revelation 2, in verse 28, I will give him the morning star. One of the rewards that he says he will give to those who follow him is the morning star. Now, Venus is called the morning star, but we know Venus is not habitable. It's got dense clouds. It's frozen on one side, boiling on the other. No way life could live there. The morning star truly is Jesus Christ. Look over to Revelation chapter 22 and verse 16. So what he's saying is that I will give you of myself, of my own power. The real morning star also isn't Venus. The real morning star is the sun. And I think if we put two and two together and, kind of think about it for a while, perhaps what Jesus Christ is telling us is I'm going to give you the power of the sun, because all things in heaven and earth have been given to Jesus Christ. And he's telling us here that we have, a lot of more power coming than we ever thought possible. In Revelation 22 and verse 16, I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things in the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David. I am the bright and morning star. But in Revelation, he said he's going to give us the morning star. So he isn't just giving us of himself. He already did that. back in about 31 AD. Now he's talking about the amount of power and the help that we are going to have. Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 13. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 13. This, you know, Peter says a lot in prophetic terms in his last two books that we overlook. But look what he plainly says here, very plainly. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, according to Jesus Christ's promise, look forward for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. So righteousness is going to dwell in the new heavens and the new earth. But the heavens right now are not suitable for dwelling, not suitable for life. So certain things have to change. But Peter very plainly says that righteousness will dwell in the new heavens. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 51. Isaiah chapter 51, where God says very plainly, I am going to plant the heavens anew. That's the David Stern translation. But the heavens as we know them are going to be transformed. Isaiah 51, we'll begin in verse 15. I am the Lord your God, who divided the sea, whose waves roared. The Lord of hosts is his name. I have put my words in your mouth. I have covered you with the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens. In other words, God says, I'm protecting you, I'm covering you, I have put my words in your mouth, that I can plant, or the Stern translation says, establish things out in the heavens. So our reward is not just on the earth. But the prophecies are pretty plain that the new heavens will contain righteousness. And in this place, he says, I'm going to plant them. I'm going to put new things out there that you have not seen and have not existed out there before. Let's go over just a few more chapters to Isaiah chapter 65. Isaiah chapter 65, beginning in verse 17. This is another astounding statement about the transformation of the heavens. It says, behold, I create new heavens and a new earth. And the former heavens and the former earth shall not be remembered nor come to mind. So what we see now in the heavens will someday be forgotten, will someday be changed so much that it will no longer be recognizable. It won't come to mind as people see it. This entire section of Isaiah lasts well into the next chapter. Let's go to chapter 66 and verse 22. The intervening time we read quite often at the feast, it talks about life in Jerusalem, children being born, people following God, a great time of celebration and comfort in Jerusalem. And then in chapter 66 and verse 22, he says, as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me. Very plainly, God says, I will make new heavens and a new earth, and they will remain a place where righteousness will dwell. It's just almost more than we can comprehend as humans. Let's go over to a couple Psalms. I wish I had more time, but I don't. But let's go over to Psalm chapter 89 and verse 5. Where God talks about who will dwell or who will be in the heavens. Well, the answer is those of God's family who are able to because they are spirit being, and perhaps beyond that, additional worlds, additional planets that are habitable, additional places where God could create more civilizations and extend what we have experienced here out to all the universe. Psalm chapter 89 and verse 5 says, the heavens will praise your wonders, O Lord. Now, right now, the heavens don't praise anything. They don't make any noise. We built all of these radio telemetric telescopes. There are several of them that are huge down in places like New Mexico, Arizona, and they are trying to receive radio waves and transmissions from other civilizations that are way out there. They are hoping beyond hope that somebody's trying to send us a message. A number of years ago, there were big announcements about we'd received this message. It was a ... message coming from space, and it was a known radio frequency, and they were all excited. And they finally looked out towards heavens, and the source of this thing ended up being a neutron star that was pulsating. And so they were all upset about it. There's a cluster of about 30,000 stars in Virgo. It's called the Virgo Cluster. Kind of a nominal name, but that's what it's called. And scientists have for years been bombarding the Virgo cluster with messages from Earth, because they are assured that Virgo, with 30,000 stars all together in real spot, has got to have planets, and there's got to be people that want to talk to us, or beings. So far, of course, it's been a one-way conversation. Nobody has written back. But here it says, the heavens are going to praise your name. At some point, the heavens will contain beings that will praise God. He says, your faithfulness also in the assembly of the saints. For who in the heavens can be compared to the Lord? So who's going to be in the heavens? Or, you know, it's implying there are beings in the heavens. But in this case, who in the heavens can be compared to the Lord? Who among the sons of the mighty can be likened to God? God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints, implying that assembly may also include some of the heavens. Let's go back also to Psalm chapter 8. Psalm chapter 8. Where it says, the works of God's hands, and it clearly refers to the heavens, not just the earth. When David was praising God here, outside the town of Gath, apparently, where Goliath was from, it says, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and nursing infants, you have ordained strength because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. Then he says, when I consider the heavens, the work of your hands, the moon, the stars that you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? Now, why are you even concerned with small, insignificant seeming mortal man? For you made him a little lower than the angels. Now David's looking at the stars in the heavens, considering the sun and the moon. He says, you've made us for a little while lower than the angels, as the Hebrew actually means for a temporary place, a temporary period of time. And you have crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. But now he's looking at the sky, he's talking about the sun and the moon and the stars, and he says, you have made man to have dominion over the works of your hands. Pretty plain that David is saying, God, how can you consider us and tell us that someday we are going to rule over all that you've created, which includes the heavens and the stars? It's almost unbelievable to comprehend. But I want to go through a few more things now, and I want you to think about you, 10, 20, 30, 50 million years later, and what you're going to have to work with. This is the Barred Spiral Galaxy. It's very pretty, and it tells you something about the way the heavens are set up. We understand through our modern-day telescopes that there are about 100 billion galaxies that we know of. The farthest we can measure are about 12 billion one direction, 4 billion the other, so it's about 16 billion light years across. But in these galaxies, you'll notice that a galaxy has a center. The center of the galaxy is called a ghetto. Now, I know that's not a good name. It has implications, but that's what they call it. They call it the ghetto because it is clustered together. The ghetto, or the center of a galaxy, is uninhabitable beyond words. There's so much dust, so much debris, so much cosmic things going on, so much gravity, that life as we know it could not possibly exist anywhere near a ghetto. And in fact, those conditions extend out into the spiral arms, where there is so much cosmic dust, so much debris and gravity going on, that life as we know it on Earth could not exist. So when you choose to make new planets, you've got to get out here in this middle space, where there's enough gravity, where there is a habitable zone, as it is called, and set your star out there and begin to rebuild things. And it has to be just the right distance from the other parts of the galaxy, or nothing is going to work. These nebula that are hundreds of light years, in fact, millions of light years across, they identify some of these zones at the top. as star-forming regions. That's where the gas is coming back together and things are imploding, and matter as we know it and objects that are sort of round and dense become formed. Now, most of what we have, of course, to work with is not habitable. When you go out to the planets and you start looking at planets, a planet that will host life, as we know it, meaning carbon-based life, would have to be a terrestrial planet. Now, of our 9 planets in our solar system, 4 are terrestrial and 5 are gaseous. The gaseous planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, Pluto, Uranus, they could not hold life because you could simply fly right through them with an airplane. The gas on the outside is a little thicker, but they are made of gas. They are not made of tierra firma. Only the first 4 planets are terrestrial in nature. So what we have to do is get all these gaseous planets to implode a lot smaller, so they become then terrestrial planets, and the heavy elements and the metals are formed, and they can then be perhaps usable. These nebula are simply one more example of what's out there is not hospitable to Earth life as we understand it. Here's the Virgo star cluster that was about 30,000 stars in a very small place comparatively. So if you're working with something like this, there are so many factors. You have all sorts of gravity, you have all sorts of hospitable zones, habitable zones, but worse than that, there's all sorts of debris in space. There are asteroids, other planets coming back. And so when you think about habitable space, what we could possibly do, there are scientists who have come up with conditions required for life as we know it. Now, since we know that all of the elements that exist on Earth are the same elements that exist everywhere else, and that all of the laws of God that govern motion, quantum physics, molecular structure, and chemistry are the same everywhere, we know that life can only exist as carbon-based life because no other life could be possibly hospitable. There was a theory one time that silicone-based life is possible. I remember Captain James T. Kirk landing on a planet one time and they had these silicone-based beings, but I think silicone has probably achieved its pinnacle in memory chips, but not in life. So the first thing is, to have life as we know it, you have to have water in a liquid state. Very, very few planets, in fact, only one that we know of, can host water in all 3 of its states, gaseous, ice, and liquid. But liquid water is absolutely essential for life. It is a solvent. It contains, like Mr. White said, we are 75% water. And almost no other planet, no other place we've ever seen in the entirety of the universe has liquid water or water in all 3 states as we have it now. A terrestrial planet with heavy metal content. Now what that means is we have a very dense metal-based planet. And in the Earth, we have a liquid core of liquid iron that is turning at a different rate than the tectonic plates. Now for all of you kids who had a science project, you know that that's called an electric motor or a generator. And what the Earth's generator does is it creates radiation fields. It creates a magnetic field that surrounds the Earth. When James T. Kirk told him to put up his magnetic shields to protect the Starship Enterprise, he wasn't joking. That works. The Earth is protected from the what's called solar winds. Solar winds consist of protons and neutrons and electrons that are going at millions of miles an hour, and they can destroy life. And they would destroy all life on the Earth if it were not for our magnetic field that diverts them around the Earth as those solar winds hit us. But that's only possible because we have our own electric motor. We have our internal liquid iron that's going at a different rate than the tectonic plates around the outside of the Earth. So when you build your planets, keep that in mind. You've got to have a shield to protect your people. Next, it has to be located in the habitable zone from a star. Now, the only star we know of that can host life is the star that we have, a dwarf star, a G2 dwarf. Because the type of heat and the type of radiation coming from our star is actually hospitable to life. Most of these stars you see out there produce a different kind of light that would be threatening. It simply could not produce life as we know it. So you have to find the G2 dwarf star, and they only come in certain sizes and they're certain ages. So the astronomers have shown that in our solar system that we have a very small habitable zone, that between the Sun and Pluto, there's a very slim place of distance between the Sun and this planet where not only water can survive, but where we have an atmosphere and where we have other conditions. It's called a habitable zone. Now, ours happens to be, now this diagram can be confusing. These are potential sizes of G2 dwarf stars. Ours, of course, is in the middle. And the Earth happens to lie in this very slim place called the habitable zone. If we were about 5% closer to the sun, we would fry. If we were more than about 12% farther away, we would freeze, and it simply would not be possible to have life. So when you finally get your G2 dwarf star built, and you've got your planets, you've got to make sure this habitable zone, which is very, very small, we're talking billions of miles here, 4 billion miles from the sun to Pluto, you've only got a sliver. It's called the habitable zone, so that you can then have a place to live. So put your planet where it can survive. Now, the size of the planet must be close to the size of the Earth. Now, the reason for that is because of our magnetic field generation and because a larger planet could not host our atmosphere. We have the most unusual atmosphere ever seen on any spherical planet in the heavens. Ours is transparent. We can see through it. It's very, very small, about 70 miles deep. Compared to the size of the Earth, it's almost incredibly thin. Venus and other planets that have atmospheres, the atmospheres are much heavier, much thicker. If Earth was much bigger, the atmosphere would implode and kill us. If Earth was much smaller, there would not be enough gravitational pull to keep the atmosphere here, and we would all die because the air would all disappear. So when you build your planet, it's got to be just almost exactly Earth's size, so you can put the atmosphere on it and keep the atmosphere here. A bigger planet won't work, a smaller planet won't work. So the size of the planet must be just right to keep the atmosphere intact. Are you taking notes on this? You're going to need them in a few years. You also have to have an oxygen-rich atmosphere. That the atmosphere we have has to have the exact proportions of oxygen and nitrogen. All other planets, by the way, that we've tried to find atmospheres in, none of this exists. There simply are none. They're hoping to find some, but the atmospheres of places like Venus are absolutely inhospitable. Jupiter's atmosphere is like milk. It's almost, you can't see through it. And the planet like Mars that has no atmosphere, we can see pictures of, and the Land Rover can land on. But when you build your planet, you have to make sure that the ratio of all of these elements in the air are exactly correct. You must have a circular rotation around the sun. Most planets rotate in an ellipse. They go way far away and come way back in close. And so this planet would get hot and then cold and hot and then cold. So when you build your planet, it has to be an exactly circular rotation around your G2 dwarf star. Any one of these things goes awry and you have no life, no chance of having life. You must have large planets nearest. Do you know what Jupiter and Venus and Neptune do for us, Mars? Their gravitational pull pulls away about 99.99% of all space objects, so we don't get hit. The space objects come in from the outside, from Pluto, from way back there. And as they are coming in, and there are many of them, by the way, God put these big planets out there that have much larger gravitational pulls than we do. And so most all of this space debris is deflected away. And you'll find most of those planets have a lot of impacts. If you look at the telescopes and the close-up views, you'll find the surface of those planets are continually being bombarded because you must have these large planets distal or farther away from your planet than the sun in order to keep all of this space debris from destroying your planet. So be sure you do that, okay? You also must have a large moon. Our moon is 1/400th the size of the sun, and the sun is exactly 400 times farther away. That's why we can have an exact total eclipse. But because of that, the moon keeps the Earth tilted at 23.5 degrees, and the moon, the gravity of the moon, slows down the rotation of the Earth, so it does not spin wildly like some planets do, or not spin at all like Venus, where it just goes around the sun with the same side facing the sun, so half of Venus boils and the other half freezes. The moon, it's not a god, but it does make life possible. It saves every one of us every day, because without that moon, we simply could not have life on the Earth. And without it being exactly the right distance, having exactly the right mass, and exactly the right gravitational pull, we could not have the tides. And of course, the moon controls our temperature because of the tides and because of the way it puts them back and forth. It spreads the Earth's heat out. Without the moon, we would simply fry and boil or freeze. So be sure you build your moon exactly like the one we have. Last of all, you have to be in the habitable zone of a galaxy. Actually, it's not last of all. There are 21 of these that the scientists who wrote the Privileged Planet book came up with. But this one is, very simply, you have to have it in the right spot in the galaxy, which is, this is a very similar galaxy, by the way, to ours, M64. And you cannot have any planets or any life within the spiral arms. There's too much debris, there is too much danger. And so you must place your planet out here somewhere where it is going to be protected, because you're not going to have all the debris, but it also has to be placed exactly right in the galaxy so the magnetics and the gravity forces work out and it will not be pulled off and taken somewhere where you don't want it. Now, what I want to do now, if the electronic things all work out, I want to show you a very small clip, a very short clip, just a few minutes. And this clip is entitled From Here to the End of the Universe. Now, what this, or Journey to the Edge of the Universe. When you watch this, I want you to notice a couple things. That when we leave Earth and go out, everything is well planned. The distances are unbelievable. But at the very end of the universe, and this is all done by computer model, but it's all done according to modern day science, when you turn back and look at God's universe from 16 billion miles away, all of the galaxies are arranged in the order of a twisted ladder. In other words, they look just like deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. And what this proves is the same creator that created the DNA that you can't even see in your cells also created the heavens and the galaxies. It is the most astounding thing you can think of, that the same architect, the same God that created your DNA, those little spiral twisted ladders inside the nucleus of every one of your cells, is the same God who created the vast heavens you can see, and it is organized exactly the same. So we'll play this little video, and I'll come back up and conclude with one scripture.
Between 1921 and 1929, Mount Wilson Observatory was the site of some of the most important discoveries in the history of astronomy. Here, more than a mile above Los Angeles, Edwin Hubble used this telescope to revolutionize scientific understanding of the structure, size, and origin of the universe. Working tirelessly from his wicker chair, Hubble determined that our Milky Way galaxy, thought by many astronomers to constitute the entire universe, was actually just one of countless billions of galaxies in a vast cosmic sea. Hubble also demonstrated that these galaxies were receding from each other, a fact that strongly implied the universe had a definite beginning. For a better perspective of the cosmos Edwin Hubble unveiled, let us embark on an imaginary journey from the top of Mount Wilson to the farthest reaches of the known universe. Traveling at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, how long would this journey take? Albert Einstein demonstrated that time would be dramatically altered for anyone traveling at such a speed. But for the sake of simplicity, we'll set aside this effect by measuring time with earthbound clocks. We depart Mount Wilson on January 1st. Hurtling through space, we quickly pass the orbit of Mars in just 4 minutes, 30 seconds. We continue on, past Jupiter and the other gas giant planets, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And 5 hours and 30 minutes after leaving the Earth, we fly past Pluto and its companion moon. Our journey has taken us more than 3.5 billion miles to the outer limits of our solar system. And back at Mount Wilson, it's still January 1st. We now take our first steps into interstellar space. Behind us, our neighboring planets and the sun quickly disappear from view. The void of space is broken only by the glimmer of stars so distant they do not yet appear to move, even though we continue to travel at the speed of light. A year passes, then 2 years, three, 4 years. Finally, on April 19th of the fifth year, we reach the Alpha Centauri system, the nearest stars to our sun. We have traveled nearly 25 trillion miles, yet our journey has barely begun. We are now 10 light years from the sun, far enough out in space that the stars within our galaxy appear to converge. 100 light years from the sun, patterns of gas and dust from an arm of the Milky Way galaxy surround us. 1,000 light years, the galaxy's arms and central disk become more defined. Yet it is not until we've traveled at the speed of light for 100,000 years that the entire spiral shape of the Milky Way is recognizable. From here on, each point of light we see is no longer an individual star, but an entire galaxy composed of billions of stars. 5 million years after beginning our journey, the Milky Way is recognized as part of a cluster of at least 30 galaxies, known as the Local Group. Bound together by gravity, the galaxies that comprise the Local Group span a region of space more than 3 million light years across. Light years out, we encounter the large Virgo cluster, containing more than 2,000 galaxies. And so it goes, as we continue to travel deeper into the cosmos. We pass cluster after galactic cluster, each a building block of a far greater framework. 1 billion years pass. 5 billion. 10 billion. Finally, after 14 billion years, we are able to discern the large-scale structure of the entire universe. At least 100 billion galaxies stretch in thread-like chains across the cosmos, forming a tapestry of unimaginable dimensions. Today, scientists still ponder the source of a universe where uniformity and precisely balanced laws and constants enable us to survey its size and structure, to contemplate its origin, and to appreciate the profound reality of our existence within it, upon a remarkable blue planet, well suited for both life and discovery.
Quickest 16 billion light years I've ever traveled, but how profound to think that it's designed like DNA and it's out there for that distance. And the same God has opened your mind to understand Him. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 2, and we'll end on this today. The final slide is called Deep Space. The Hubble telescope focused on a piece of sky just north of the northern of the Big Dipper, a piece of sky where there was no recorded star previously. The piece of sky is the size of a dime at 50 feet. So put a dime out there 50 feet away, and that's the size of sky they looked at. And as the telescope remained open, this came into view, approximately 3,000 galaxies. And they then multiplied that amount of galaxies by the entire subtended sphere around the Earth, and came up with the minimum number of about 120 billion galaxies that are out there. But think about which ones of these you'd like to remodel, make habitable, hospitable for man, because According to the Word of God, only the Earth right now was made correctly for man to live on, and every effort of scientists to prove otherwise has been fruitless. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 3. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which is at the first began to be spoken by the Lord as he was confirmed to those who heard him? God bearing witness with both signs and wonders, and even his heavens, the new heavens are going to be a sign and a wonder. Various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will. God does all of these things. He opens our minds, this powerful miracle of being here and keeping his feast and thinking about what the future might hold for us. It says, for he has not put the world to come, of which we speak, in subjection to angels. The angels are not going to rule the world to come. Satan the devil rules this world now, but he's going to be locked up. The other angels will turn over their territory to those who are now God. By one, he testified in a certain place, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care of him? You have made him for a little while lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honor and set him over the works of your hands, and you have put all things in subjection under his feet. That will happen, and all things include this fabulous universe that we've only seen a very small piece of today. It says, for in that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. Everything God created will someday be under the sons of God, those who have been resurrected, who now have his name, who now have his power, who now have been given the power of the Son. All things are going to be in subjection to those who have given their life to God, who have learned the lessons we've heard of at this feast, have learned the lessons of humility and teachability and of reverence, and as Jesus Christ said, to love God with all their heart, with all their mind, and all their being. But now we have not yet seen all these things put under him, but we see Jesus Christ, our example, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor. We see that Christ lived like we did. He was a human, but now he's resurrected. He's on high. He has glory and honor. He has all power in heaven and earth, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. So now we know he is ruling in the heavens, and it says, for it was fitting for him, for whom are all things. Everything that was created is for Jesus Christ. He's going to be the ruler in bringing many sons into glory. So he did these things to bring many more brethren, many more God family members into glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. Both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all one, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren. He's not ashamed to call you his brother if you have given yourself to him. He says, I will declare your name to my brethren in the midst of the assembly, which can include everything he has created. I will sing praise to you, and again I will put my trust in him, and again here am I and the children whom God has given me. Jesus Christ is anxious for the day when he can say, here am I and the brethren, the children whom God has given me. He has done everything to bring many sons into glory, and everything that has been created is for him and for his purpose. And someday he will place everything he has created under the authority of we mortal humans who have now become like him. We shouldn't leave the feast thinking small about our future, because God is huge. The universe is 16 billion light years across, and maybe even larger. Today, when you go home, think about what you've seen and about what your future might hold. Think bigger than you ever have about the new heavens and the new earth.